Black Boy, Disc 11.
Part 2. The Horror and the Glory. Sometimes I wonder, huh? Wonder if other people wonder, huh? Sometimes I wonder, huh? Wonder if other people wonder, huh? Just like I do. Oh, my Lord. Just like I do. Negro Folk Song. Chapter 15. My first glimpse of the flat black stretches of Chicago depressed and dismayed me, mocked all my fantasies. Chicago seemed an unreal city, whose mythical houses were built of slabs of black coal, wreathed in palls of gray smoke. Houses whose foundations were sinking slowly into the dank prairie. Flashes of steam showed intermittently on the wide horizon, gleaming translucently in the winter sun. The din of the city entered my consciousness, entered to remain for years to come. The year was 1927. What would happen to me here? Would I survive? My expectations were modest. I wanted only a job. Hunger had long been my daily companion. Diversion and recreation, with the exception of reading, were unknown. In all my life, though surrounded by many people, I had not a single satisfying, sustained relationship with another human being, and, not having had any, I didn't miss it. I made no demands whatever upon others. The train rolled into the depot. Aunt Maggie and I got off and walked slowly through the crowds into the station. I looked about to see if there were signs saying, "For white, for colored." I saw none. Black people and white people moved about, each seemingly intent upon his private mission. There was no racial fear. Indeed, each person acted as though no one existed but himself. It was strange to pause before a crowded newsstand and buy a newspaper without having to wait until a white man was served. And yet, because everything was so new, I began to grow tense again, although it was a different sort of tension than I had known before. I knew that this machine city was governed by strange laws, and I wondered if I would ever learn them. As we waited for a streetcar to take us to Aunt Cleo's home for temporary lodging, I looked northward at towering buildings of steel and stone. There were no curves here, no trees, only angles, lines, squares, bricks, and copper wires. Occasionally the ground beneath my feet shook from some faraway pounding, and I felt that this world, despite its massiveness, was somehow dangerously fragile. Streetcars screeched past over steel tracks. Cars honked their horns. Clipped speech sounded about me. As I stood in the icy wind, I wanted to talk to Aunt Maggie, to ask her questions, but her tight face made me hold my tongue. I was learning already, from the frantic light in her eyes, the strain that the city imposed upon its people. I was seized by doubt. Should I have come here? But going back was impossible. I had fled a known terror, and perhaps I could cope with this unknown terror that lay ahead. The streetcar came. Aunt Maggie motioned for me to get on and pushed me toward a seat in which a white man sat looking blankly out the window. I sat down beside the man and looked straight ahead of me. After a moment, I stole a glance at the white man out of the corners of my eyes. He was still staring out the window, his mind fastened upon some inward thought. I didn't exist for him. I was as far from his mind as the stone buildings that swept past in the street. It would have been illegal for me to sit beside him in the part of the South that I had come from. The car swept past soot-blackened buildings, stopping at each block, jerking again into motion. The conductor called street names in a tone that I couldn't understand. People got on and off the car, but they never glanced at one another. Each person seemed to regard the other as a part of the city landscape. The white man who sat beside me rose, and I turned my knees aside to let him pass. And another white man sat beside me and buried his face in a newspaper. How could that possibly be? Was he conscious of my blackness? We went to Aunt Cleo's address and found that she was living in a rented room. I had imagined that she lived in an apartment, and I was disappointed. I rented a room from Aunt Cleo's landlady and decided to keep it until I got a job. I was baffled. Everything seemed makeshift, temporary. I caught an abiding sense of insecurity in the personalities of the people around me. I found Aunt Cleo aged beyond her years. Her husband, a product of a southern plantation, had, like my father, gone off and left her. Why had he left? My aunt couldn't answer. She was beaten by the life of the city, just as my mother had been beaten. Wherever my eyes turned, they saw stricken, frightened black faces, trying vainly to cope with a civilization that they did not understand. I felt lonely. I had fled one insecurity and had embraced another. When I rose the next morning, the temperature had dropped below zero. The house was as cold to me as the southern streets had been in winter. I dressed, doubling my clothing. I ate in a restaurant, caught a streetcar, and rode south. Rode until I could see no more black faces on the sidewalks. I had now crossed the boundary line of the Black Belt and had entered the territory where jobs were perhaps to be had from white folks. I walked the streets and looked into shop windows until I saw a sign in a delicatessen, "Porter Wanted." I went in, and a stout white woman came to me.
"What do you want?" she asked.
The voice jarred me. She's Jewish, I thought, remembering with shame the obscenities I used to shout at Jewish storekeepers in Arkansas. "I thought maybe you needed a porter," I said.
"Mr. Hoffman isn't here yet," she said. "Will you wait?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Sit down."
"No, ma'am, I'll wait outside."
"But it's cold out there," she said.
"That's all right," I said. She shrugged. I went to the sidewalk. I waited for half an hour in the bitter cold, regretting that I hadn't remained in the warm store, but unable to go back inside. A bald, stoutish white man went into the store and pulled off his coat. Yes, he was the boss man. I went in.
"So, you want a job?" he asked.
"Yes, sir," I answered, guessing at the meaning of his words.
"Where you work before?"
"In Memphis, Tennessee."
"My brother-in-law worked in Tennessee once," he said.
I was hired. The work was easy, but I found to my dismay that I couldn't understand a third of what was said to me. My slow southern ears were baffled by their clouded, thick accents. One morning, Mrs. Hoffman asked me to go to a neighboring store, it was owned by a cousin of hers, and get a can of chicken a la king. I had never heard the phrase before, and I asked her to repeat it.
"Don't you know nothing?"
she demanded of me. "If you would write it down for me, I'd know what to get," I ventured timidly.
"I can't wait,"
she shouted in a sudden fury.
"What kind of boy is you?"
I memorized the separate sounds that she had uttered and went to the neighboring store. "Mrs. Hoffman wants a can of Cheek King R. Lar King," I said slowly, hoping that he wouldn't think I was being offensive.
"All right,"
he said, after staring at me a moment. He put a can into a paper bag and gave it to me. Outside in the street, I opened the bag and read the label. Chicken a la King. I cursed, disgusted with myself. I knew those words. It had been her thick accent that had thrown me off. Yet, I wasn't angry with her for speaking broken English. My English, too, was broken. But why could she not have taken more patience? Only one answer came to my mind. I was black, and she did not care. Or so I thought. I was persisting in reading my present environment in the light of my old one. I reasoned thus. Though English was my native tongue, and America my native land, she, an alien, could operate a store and earn a living in a neighborhood where I couldn't even live. I reasoned further that she was aware of this and was trying to protect her position against me. It wasn't until I had left the delicatessen job that I saw how grossly I had misread the motives and attitudes of Mr. Hoffman and his wife. I hadn't yet learned anything that would have helped me to thread my way through these perplexing racial relations. Accepting my environment at its face value, trapped by my own emotions, I kept asking myself, what had black people done to bring this crazy world upon them? The fact of the separation of white and black was clear to me. It was its effect upon the personalities of people that stumped and dismayed me. I didn't feel that I was a threat to anybody. Yet as soon as I had grown old enough to think, I had learned that my entire personality, my aspirations, had long ago been discounted. That, in a measure, the very meaning of the words I spoke couldn't be fully understood. And when I contemplated the area of no man's land into which the Negro mind in America had been shunted, I wondered if there had ever existed in all human history a more corroding and devastating attack upon the personalities of men than the idea of racial discrimination. In order to escape the racial attack that went to the roots of my life, I would have gladly accepted any way of life but the one in which I found myself. I would have agreed to live under a system of feudal oppression, not because I preferred feudalism, but because I felt that feudalism made use of a limited part of a man, defined him, his rank, his function in society. I would have consented to live under the most rigid type of dictatorship, for I felt that dictatorships, too, defined the use of men, however degrading that use might be. While working in Memphis, I had stood aghast as Shorty had offered himself to be kicked by the white men. But now, while working in Chicago, I was learning that perhaps even a kick was better than uncertainty. I had elected in my fevered search for honorable adjustment to the American scene not to submit, and in doing so, I had embraced the daily horror of anxiety, of tension, of eternal disquiet. I could now sympathize with, though I could never bring myself to approve, those tortured blacks who had given up and had gone to their white tormentors and had said, "Kick me, if that's all there is for me. Kick me and let me feel at home, let me have peace." Color hate defined the place of black life as below that of white life. And the black man, responding to the same dreams as the white man, strove to bury within his heart his awareness of this difference, because it made him lonely and afraid. Hated by whites, and being an organic part of the culture that hated him, the black man grew in turn to hate in himself that which others hated in him. But pride would make him hide his self-hate, for he wouldn't want whites to know that he was so thoroughly conquered by them that his total life was conditioned by their attitude. But in the act of hiding his self-hate, he couldn't help but hate those who evoked his self-hate in him. So each part of his day would be consumed in a war with himself. A good part of his energy would be spent in keeping control of his unruly emotions. Emotions which he hadn't wished to have, but couldn't help having. Held at bay by the hate of others, preoccupied with his own feelings, he was continuously at war with reality. He became inefficient, less able to see and judge the objective world. And when he reached that state, the white people looked at him and laughed and said, "Look, didn't I tell you niggers were that way?" To solve this tangle of balked emotion, I loaded the empty part of the ship of my personality with fantasies of ambition to keep it from toppling over into the sea of senselessness. Like any other American, I dreamed of going into business and making money. I dreamed of working for a firm that would allow me to advance until I reached an important position. I even dreamed of organizing secret groups of blacks to fight all whites. And if the blacks wouldn't agree to organize, then they would have to be fought. I would end up again with self-hate, but it was now a self-hate that was projected outward upon other blacks. Yet I knew, with that part of my mind that the whites had given me, that none of my dreams was possible. Then I would hate myself for allowing my mind to dwell upon the unattainable. Thus, the circle would complete itself. Slowly I began to forge in the depths of my mind a mechanism that repressed all the dreams and desires that the Chicago streets, the newspapers, the movies were evoking in me. I was going through a second childhood. A new sense of the limit of the possible was being born in me. What could I dream of that had the barest possibility of coming true? I could think of nothing. And slowly, it was upon exactly that nothingness that my mind began to dwell. That constant sense of wanting without having, of being hated without reason. A dim notion of what life meant to a Negro in America was coming to consciousness in me. Not in terms of external events, lynchings, Jim Crowism, and all the endless brutalities, but in terms of crossed-up feeling, of psyche pain. I sensed that Negro life was a sprawling land of unconscious suffering, and there were but few Negroes who knew the meaning of their lives, who could tell their story. Word reached me that an examination for postal clerk was impending, and at once I filed an application and waited. As the date for the examination drew near, I was faced with another problem. How could I get a free day without losing my job? In the South, it would have been an unwise policy for a Negro to have gone to his white boss and asked for time to take an examination for another job. It would have implied that the Negro didn't like to work for the white boss, that he felt he wasn't receiving just consideration, and, inasmuch as most jobs that Negroes held in the South involved a personal, paternalistic relationship, he would have been risking an argument that might have led to violence. I now began to speculate about what kind of man Mr. Hoffman was, and I found that I didn't know him. That is, I didn't know his basic attitude toward Negroes. If I asked him, would he be sympathetic enough to allow me time off with pay? I needed the money. Perhaps he would say, "Go home and stay home if you don't like this job." I wasn't sure of him. I decided, therefore, that I'd better not risk it. I would forfeit the money and stay away without telling him. The examination was scheduled to take place on a Monday. I had been working steadily, and I'd be too tired to do my best if I took the examination without the benefit of rest. I decided to stay away from the shop Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. But what could I tell Mr. Hoffman? Yes, I would tell him that I'd been ill. No, that was too thin. I would tell him that my mother had died in Memphis, and that I'd gone down to bury her. That might work. I took the examination, and when I came to the store on Tuesday, Mr. Hoffman was astonished, of course. "I didn't think you would ever come back," he said. "I'm awfully sorry, Mr. Hoffman."
"What happened?"
"My mother died in Memphis, and I had to go down and bury her," I lied. He looked at me, then shook his head.
"Rich, you lie," he said.
I'm not lying. I lied stoutly.
You wanted to do something, so you stayed away,
he said, shrugging. No, sir. I'm telling you the truth. I piled another lie upon the first one.
No, you lie. You disappoint me, he said.
Well, all I can do is tell you the truth, I lied indignantly.
Why didn't you use the phone?
I didn't think of it. I told a fresh lie.
Rich, if your mother die, you would tell me, he said.
I didn't have time. Had to catch the train. I lied yet again.
Where did you get the money?
My aunt gave it to me, I said, disgusted that I had to lie and lie again.
I don't want a boy that tells lies, he said.
I don't lie. I lied passionately to protect my lies. Mrs. Hoffman joined in, and both of them hammered at me.
We know. You come from the South. You feel you can't tell us the truth. But we don't bother you. We don't feel like people in the South. We treat you nice, don't we?
They asked. Yes, ma'am, I mumbled.
Then why lie?
I'm not lying. I lied with all my strength. I became angry, because I knew that they knew that I was lying. I had lied to protect myself, and then I had to lie to protect my lie. I had met so many white faces that would have violently disapproved of my taking the examination that I couldn't have risked telling Mr. Hoffman the truth. But how could I now tell him that I had lied because I was so unsure of myself? Lying was bad, but revealing my own sense of insecurity would have been worse. It would have been shameful, and I didn't like to feel ashamed. Their attitudes had proved utterly amazing. They were taking time out from their duties in the store to talk to me, and I had never encountered anything like that from whites before. A southern white man would have said, "Get the hell out of here," or, "All right, nigger, get to work." But no white people had ever stood their ground and probed at me, questioned me at such length. It dawned upon me that they were trying to treat me as an equal, which made it even more impossible for me ever to tell them that I had lied, why I had lied. I felt that if I confessed, I would give them a moral advantage over me that would be unbearable.
All right, stay and work, Mr. Hoffman said. I know you're lying, but I don't care, Rich.
I wanted to quit. He had insulted me, but I liked him in spite of myself. Yes, I had done wrong, but how on earth could I have known the kind of people I was working for? Perhaps Mr. Hoffman would have gladly consented for me to take the examination, but my hopes had been far weaker than my powerful fears. Working with them from day to day, and knowing that they knew I had lied, from fear, crushed me. I knew that they pitied me, and pitied the fear in me. I resolved to quit, and risk hunger rather than stay with them. I left the job the following Saturday, not telling them that I wouldn't be back, not possessing the heart to say goodbye. I just wanted to go quickly and have them forget that I had ever worked for them. After an idle week, I got a job as a dishwasher in a Northside cafe that had just opened. My boss, a white woman, directed me in unpacking barrels of dishes, setting up new tables, painting, and so on. I had charge of serving breakfast. In the late afternoons, I carted trays of food to patrons in the hotel who didn't want to come down to eat. My wages were $15 a week. The hours were long, but I ate my meals on the job. The cook was an elderly Finnish woman with a sharp, bony face. There were several white waitresses. I was the only Negro in the cafe. The waitresses were a hard, brisk lot, and I was keenly aware of how their attitudes contrasted with those of Southern white girls. They hadn't been taught to keep a gulf between me and themselves. They were relatively free of the heritage of racial hate. One morning, as I was making coffee, Cora came forward with a tray loaded with food and squeezed against me to draw a cup of coffee.
"Pardon me, Richard," she said.
"Oh, that's all right," I said in an even tone. But I was aware that she was a white girl, and that her body had pressed closely against mine, an incident that had never happened to me before in my life, an incident charged with the memory of dread. But she was not conscious of my blackness, or of what her actions would have meant in the South. And had I not been born in the South, her trivial act would have been as unnoticed by me as it was by her. As she stood close to me, I could not help thinking that if a Southern white girl had wanted to draw a cup of coffee, she would have commanded me to step aside so that she might not come in contact with me. The work of the hot and busy kitchen would have had to cease for the moment so that I could have taken my tainted body far enough away to allow the Southern white girl a chance to get a cup of coffee. There lay a deep emotional safety in knowing that the white girl, who was now leaning carelessly against me, was not thinking of me, had no deep, vague, irrational fright that made her feel that I was a creature to be avoided at all costs. One summer morning, a white girl came late to work and rushed into the pantry where I was busy. She went into the women's room and changed her clothes. I heard the door open, and a second later, I was surprised to hear her voice.
"Richard, quick, tie my apron."
She was standing with her back to me, and the strings of her apron dangled loose. There was a moment of indecision on my part. Then I took the two loose strings and carried them around her body and brought them again to her back and tied them in a clumsy knot.
"Thanks a million,"
she said, grasping my hand for a split second, and was gone. I continued my work, filled with all the possible meanings that that tiny, simple human event could have meant to any Negro in the South, where I had spent most of my hungry days. I didn't feel any admiration for the girls, nor any hate. My attitude was one of abiding and friendly wonder. For the most part, I was silent with them, though I knew that I had a firmer grasp of life than most of them. As I worked, I listened to their talk and perceived its puzzled, wandering, superficial fumbling with the problems and facts of life. There were many things they wondered about that I could have explained to them, but I never dared. During my lunch hour, which I spent on a bench in a nearby park, the waitresses would come and sit beside me, talking at random, laughing, joking, smoking cigarettes. I learned about their tawdry dreams, their simple hopes, their home lives, their fear of feeling anything deeply, their sex problems, their husbands. They were an eager, restless, talkative, ignorant bunch, but casually kind and impersonal for all that. They knew nothing of hate and fear, and strove instinctively to avoid all passion. I often wondered what they were trying to get out of life, but I never stumbled upon a clue, and I doubt if they themselves had any notion. They lived on the surface of their days. Their smiles were surface smiles, and their tears were surface tears. Negroes lived a truer and deeper life than they, but I wished that Negroes, too, could live as thoughtlessly, serenely, as they. The girls never talked of their feelings. None of them possessed the insight or the emotional equipment to understand themselves or others. How far apart in culture we stood. All my life I had done nothing but feel and cultivate my feelings. All their lives they had done nothing but strive for petty goals, the trivial material prizes of American life. We shared a common tongue, but my language was a different language from theirs. It was in the psychological distance that separated the races that the deepest meaning of the problem of the Negro lay for me. For these poor, ignorant white girls to have understood my life would have meant nothing short of a vast revolution in theirs, and I was convinced that what they needed to make them complete and grown up in their living was the inclusion in their personalities of a knowledge of lives such as I lived and suffered containedly. As I in memory think back now upon those girls and their lives, I feel that for white America to understand the significance of the problem of the Negro will take a bigger and tougher America than any we have yet known. I feel that America's past is too shallow, her national character too superficially optimistic, her very morality too suffused with color hate for her to accomplish so vast and complex a task. Culturally, the Negro represents a paradox. Though he is an organic part of the nation, he is excluded by the entire tide and direction of American culture. Frankly, it is felt to be right to exclude him, and it is felt to be wrong to admit him freely. Therefore, if within the confines of its present culture the nation ever seeks to purge itself of its color hate, it will find itself at war with itself, convulsed by a spasm of emotional and moral confusion. If the nation ever finds itself examining its real relation to the Negro, it will find itself doing infinitely more than that. For the anti-Negro attitudes of whites represents but a tiny part, though a symbolically significant one, of the moral attitude of the nation. Our too young and too new America, lusty because it is lonely, aggressive because it is afraid, insists upon seeing the world in terms of good and bad, the holy and the evil, the high and the low, the white and the black. Our America is frightened of fact, of history, of processes, of necessity. It hugs the easy way of damning those whom it cannot understand, of excluding those who look different, and it salves its conscience with a self-draped cloak of righteousness. Am I damning my native land? No, for I, too, share these faults of character. And I really do not think that America, adolescent and cocksure, a stranger to suffering and travail, an enemy of passion and sacrifice, is ready to probe into its most fundamental beliefs. I know that not race alone, nor color alone, but the daily values that give meaning to life stood between me and those white girls with whom I worked. Their constant outward looking, their mania for radios, cars, and 1,000 other trinkets made them dream and fix their eyes upon the trash of life, made it impossible for them to learn a language which could have taught them to speak of what was in their or others' hearts. The words of their souls were the syllables of popular songs. The essence of the irony of the plight of the Negro in America to me is that he is doomed to live in isolation, while those who condemn him seek the basest goals of any people on the face of the earth. Perhaps it would be possible for the Negro to become reconciled to his plight if he could be made to believe that his sufferings were for some remote, high, sacrificial end. But sharing the culture that condemns him and seeing that a lust for trash is what binds the nation to his claims is what sets storms to rolling in his soul. Though I had fled the pressure of the South, my outward conduct had not changed. I had been schooled to present an unalteringly smiling face, and I continued to do so, despite the fact that my environment allowed more open expression. I hid my feelings and avoided all relationships with whites that might cause me to reveal them. One afternoon, the boss lady entered the kitchen and found me sitting on a box reading a copy of the American Mercury.
"What on earth are you reading?" she demanded.
I was at once on guard, though I knew I didn't have to be.
"Oh, just a magazine," I said. "Where did you get it?" she asked.
"Oh, I just found it," I lied. I had bought it.
"Do you understand it?" she asked.
"Yes, ma'am."
"Well," she exclaimed, "the colored dishwasher reads the American Mercury."
She walked away shaking her head. My feelings were mixed. I was glad that she had learned that I wasn't completely dumb, yet I felt a little angry because she seemed to think it odd for dishwashers to read magazines. Thereafter, I kept my books and magazines wrapped in newspaper so that no one would see them, reading them at home or on the streetcar to and from work. Tilly, the Finnish cook, was a tall, ageless, red-faced, raw-boned woman with long, snow-white hair, which she balled in a knot at the nape of her neck. She cooked expertly and was superbly efficient. One morning, as I passed the sizzling stove, I thought I heard Tilly cough and spit. I paused and looked carefully to see where her spittle had gone, but I saw nothing. Her face, obscured by steam, was bent over a big pot. My senses told me that Tilly had coughed and spat into that pot, but my heart told me that no human being could possibly be so filthy. I decided to watch her. An hour or so later, I heard Tilly clear her throat with a grunt, saw her cough, and spit into the boiling soup. I held my breath. I didn't want to believe what I had seen. Should I tell the boss lady? Would she believe me? I watched Tilly for another day to make sure that she was spitting into the food. She was. There was no doubt of it. But who would believe me if I told them what was happening? I was the only black person in the cafe. Perhaps they would think that I hated the cook. I stopped eating my meals there and bided my time. The business of the cafe was growing rapidly, and a Negro girl was hired to make salads. I went to her at once.
"Look, can I trust you?" I asked.
"What are you talking about?" she asked.
"I want you to say nothing, but watch that cook."
"For what?"
"Now, don't get scared. Just watch the cook."
She looked at me as though she thought I was crazy, and frankly, I felt that perhaps I ought not to say anything to anybody.
"What do you mean?" she demanded.
"All right," I said, "I'll tell you. That cook spits in the food."
"What are you saying?" she asked aloud.
"Keep quiet," I said.
"Spitting?" she asked me in a whisper. "Why would she do that?"
"I don't know, but watch her." She walked away from me with a funny look in her eyes. But half an hour later, she came rushing to me, looking ill, sinking into a chair.
"Oh, God, I feel awful."
"Did you see it?"
"She is spitting in the food."
"What ought we do?" I asked.
"Tell the lady," she said.
"She wouldn't believe me," I said. She widened her eyes as she understood. We were black, and the cook was white.
"But I can't work here if she's going to do that," she said.
"Then you tell her," I said.
"She wouldn't believe me either," she said.
She rose and ran to the women's room. When she returned, she stared at me. We were two Negroes, and we were silently asking ourselves if the white boss lady would believe us if we told her that her expert white cook was spitting in the food all day long as it cooked upon the stove.
"I don't know," she wailed in a whisper and walked away.
I thought of telling the waitresses about the cook, but I couldn't get up the nerve. Many of the girls were friendly with Tilly. Yet I couldn't let the cook spit in the food all day. That was wrong by any human standard of conduct. I washed dishes, thinking, wondering. I served breakfast, thinking, wondering. I served meals in the apartments of patrons upstairs, thinking, wondering. Each time I picked up a tray of food, I felt like retching. Finally, the Negro salad girl came to me and handed me her purse and hat. "I'm going to tell her and quit, goddamn," she said. "I'll quit too if she doesn't fire her," I said. "Oh, she won't believe me," she wailed in agony.
"You tell her. You're a woman. She might believe you."
Her eyes welled with tears, and she sat for a long time. Then she rose and went abruptly into the dining room. I went to the door and peered. Yes, she was at the desk, talking to the boss lady. She returned to the kitchen and went into the pantry. I followed her.
"Did you tell her?" I asked.
"Yes."
"What did she say?"
"She said I was crazy."
"Oh, God," I said.
"She just looked at me with those gray eyes of hers," the girl said.
"Why would Tilly do that?"
"I don't know," I said. The boss lady came to the door and called the girl. Both of them went into the dining room. Tilly came over to me. A hard, cold look was in her eyes.
"What's happening here?" she asked.
"I don't know," I said, wanting to slap her across the mouth. She muttered something and went back to the stove, coughed, spat into a bubbling pot. I left the kitchen and went into the back areaway to breathe. The boss lady came out.
"Richard?"
she said. Her face was pale. I was smoking a cigarette, and I did not look at her.
"Is this true?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"It couldn't be. Do you know what you're saying?"
"Just watch her," I said.
"I don't know," she moaned.
She looked crushed. She went back into the dining room, but I saw her watching the cook through the doors. I watched both of them, the boss lady and the cook, praying that the cook would spit again. She did. The boss lady came into the kitchen and stared at Tilly, but she didn't utter a word. She burst into tears and ran back into the dining room.
"What's happening here?" Tilly demanded.
No one answered. The boss lady came out and tossed Tilly her hat, coat, and money.
"Now get out of here, you dirty dog," she said.
Tilly stared, then slowly picked up her hat, coat, and the money. She stood for a moment, wiped sweat from her forehead with her hand, then spat, this time on the floor. She left. Nobody was ever able to fathom why Tilly liked to spit into the food. Brooding over Tilly, I recalled the time when the boss man in Mississippi had come to me and had tossed my wages to me and said,
"Get out, nigger. I don't like your looks."
And I wondered if a Negro who did not smile and grin was as morally loathsome to whites as a cook who spat into the food. I worked at the cafe all spring, and in June I was called for temporary duty in the post office. My confidence soared. If I obtained an appointment as a regular clerk, I could spend at least 5 hours a day writing. I reported at the post office and was sworn in as a temporary clerk. I earned 70 cents an hour, and I went to bed each night now with a full stomach for the first time in my life. When I worked nights, I wrote during the day. When I worked days, I wrote during the night. But the happiness of having a job did not keep another worry from rising to plague me. Before I could receive a permanent appointment, I would have to take a physical examination, and the weight requirement was 125 pounds, and I, with my long years of semi-starvation, barely tipped the scales at 110. Frantically, I turned all of my spare money into food and ate. But my skin and flesh would not respond to the food. Perhaps I wasn't eating the right diet. Perhaps my chronic anxiety kept my weight down. I drank milk, ate steak,
but it didn't give me an extra ounce of flesh. I visited a doctor who told me that there was nothing wrong with me except malnutrition, that I must eat and sleep long hours. I did, and my weight remained the same. I knew now that my job was temporary, and that when the time came for my appointment, I would have to resume my job hunting again. While I crammed my stomach, I read Stein's Three Lives, Crane's The Red Badge of Courage, and Dostoevsky's The Possessed, all of which revealed new realms of feeling. But the most important discoveries came when I veered from fiction proper into the field of psychology and sociology. I ran through volumes that bore upon the causes of my conduct and the conduct of my family. I studied tables of figures relating population density to insanity, relating housing to disease, relating school and recreational opportunities to crime, relating various forms of neurotic behavior to environment, relating racial insecurities to the conflicts between whites and blacks. I still had no friends, casual or intimate, and felt the need for none. I had developed a self-sufficiency that kept me distant from others, emotionally and psychologically. Occasionally, I went to house rent parties, parties given by working-class families to raise money to pay the landlord, the admission to which was a quarter or a half dollar. At these affairs, I drank home-brewed beer, ate spaghetti and chitlins, laughed and talked with black southern-born girls who worked as domestic servants in white middle-class homes. But with none of them did my relations rest upon my deepest feelings. I discussed what I read with no one, and to none did I confide. Emotionally, I was withdrawn from the objective world. My desires floated loosely within the walls of my consciousness, contained and controlled. As a protective mechanism, I developed a terse, cynical mode of speech that rebuffed those who sought to get too close to me. Conversation was my way of avoiding expression. My words were reserved for those times when I sat down alone to write. My face was always a deadpan, or a mask of general friendliness. No word or event could jar me into a gesture of enthusiasm or despair. A slowly, hesitantly spoken, "Yeah," was my general verbal reaction to almost everything I heard. "That's pretty good," said with a slow nod of the head, was my approval. "Oh, no," muttered with a cold smile, was my rejection. Even though I reacted deeply, my true feelings raced along underground, hidden. I did not act in this fashion deliberately. I didn't prefer this kind of relationship with people. I wanted a life in which there was a constant oneness of feeling with others, in which the basic emotions of life were shared, in which common memory formed a common past, in which collective hope reflected a national future. But I knew that no such thing was possible in my environment. The only ways in which I felt that my feelings could go outward without fear of rude rebuff or searing reprisal was in writing or reading, and to me, they were ways of living. Aunt Maggie had now rented an apartment in which I shared a rear room. My mother and brother came, and all three of us slept in that one room. There was no window, just four walls and a door. My excessive reading puzzled Aunt Maggie. She sensed my fiercely indrawn nature, and she didn't like it. Being of an open, talkative disposition, she declared that I was going about the business of living wrongly, that reading books wouldn't help me at all. But nothing she said had any effect. I had long ago hardened myself to criticism. "Boy, are you reading for law?" my aunt would demand. "No." "Then why are you reading all the time?"
"I like to."
"But what do you get out of it?"
"I get a great deal out of it."
and I knew that my words sounded wild and foolish in my environment, where reading was almost unknown, where the highest item of value was a dime or a dollar, an apartment or a job, where if one aspired at all, it was to be a doctor or a lawyer, a shopkeeper, or a politician. The most valued pleasure of the people I knew was a car. The most cherished experience, a bottle of whiskey. The most sought-after prize, somebody else's wife. I had no sense of being inferior or superior to the people about me. I merely felt that they'd had no chance to learn to live differently. I never criticized them or praised them, yet they felt in my neutrality a deeper rejection of them than if I had cursed them. Repeatedly, I took stabs at writing, but the results were so poor that I would tear up the sheets. I was striving for a level of expression that matched those of the novels I read, but I always somehow failed to get onto the page what I thought and felt. Failing at sustained narrative, I compromised by playing with single sentences and phrases. Under the influence of Stein's Three Lives, I spent hours and days pounding out disconnected sentences for the sheer love of words. I would write, "The soft, melting hunk of butter trickled in gold down the stringy grooves of the split yam." Or, "The child's clumsy fingers fumbled in sleep, feeling vainly for the wish of its dream." The old man huddled in the dark doorway, his bony face lit by the burning yellow in the windows of distant skyscrapers. My purpose was to capture a physical state or movement that carried a strong subjective impression, an accomplishment which seemed supremely worth struggling for. If I could fasten the mind of the reader upon words so firmly that he would forget words and be conscious only of his response, I felt that I would be in sight of knowing how to write narrative. I strove to master words, to make them disappear, to make them important by making them new, to make them melt into a rising spiral of emotional stimuli, each greater than the other, each feeding and reinforcing the other, and all ending in an emotional climax that would drench the reader with a sense of a new world. That was the single aim of my living. Autumn came, and I was called for my physical examination for the position of regular postal clerk. I had not told my mother or brother or aunt that I knew I would fail. On the morning of the examination, I drank 2 quarts of buttermilk, ate 6 bananas, but it didn't hoist the red arrow of the government scales to the required mark of 125 pounds. I went home and sat disconsolately in my back room, hating myself, wondering where I could find another job. I had almost got my hands upon a decent job and had lost it, had let it slip through my fingers. Waves of self-doubt rose to haunt me. Was I always to hang on the fringes of life? What I wanted was truly modest, and yet my past, my diet, my hunger had snatched it from me before my eyes. But these self-doubts didn't last long. I dulled the sense of loss through reading, reading, writing, and more writing. The loss of my job didn't evoke in me any hostility toward the system of rules that had barred my first grasp at the material foundations of American life. I felt that it was unfair that my lack of a few pounds of flesh should deprive me of a chance of a good job, but I had long ago emotionally rejected the world in which I lived, and my reaction was, well, this is the system by which people want the world to run, whether it helps them or not. To me, my losing was only another manifestation of that queer, material way of American living that computed everything in terms of the concrete. Weight, color, race, fur coats, radios, electric refrigerators, cars, money. It seemed that I simply couldn't fit into a materialistic life. The living arrangement of my mother, brother, and Aunt Maggie, now that I had no promise of being a postal clerk, quickly deteriorated. In Aunt Maggie's eyes, I was a plainly marked failure, and she feared that perhaps she would have to feed me. The emotional atmosphere in the cramped quarters became tense, ugly, petty, bickering. Fault was found with my reading and writing. It was claimed that I was swelling the electric bill. Though I had saved almost no money, I decided to rent an apartment. Aunt Cleo was living in a rented room, and I invited her to share the apartment with me, my mother and brother, and she consented. We moved into a tiny, dingy, two-room den, in whose kitchen a wall bed fitted snugly into a corner near the stove. The place was alive with vermin, and the smell of cooking hung in the air day and night. I asked for my job back at the cafe, and the boss lady allowed me to return. Again I served breakfast, washed dishes, carted trays of food up into the apartments. Another postal examination was scheduled for spring, and to that end, I made eating an obsession. I ate what I didn't want to eat, drank milk when it sickened me. Slowly, my starved body responded to food and overcame the lean years of Mississippi, Arkansas, and Tennessee, counteracting the flesh-sapping anxiety of fear-filled days. I spent my nights reading Proust's A Remembrance of Things Past, admiring the lucid, subtle, but strong prose, stupefied by its dazzling magic, awed by the vast, delicate, intricate, and psychological structure of the Frenchman's epic of death and decadence. But it crushed me with hopelessness, for I wanted to write of people in my environment with an equal thoroughness, and the burning example before my eyes made me feel that I never could. My ability to endure tension had now grown amazingly. From the accidental pain of southern years, from anxiety that I had sought to avoid, from fear that had been too painful to bear, I had learned to like my unintermittent burden of feeling, but had become habituated to acting with all of my being, had learned to seek those areas of life, those situations, where I knew that events would complement my own inner mood. I was conscious of what was happening to me. I knew that my attitude of watchful wonder had usurped all other feelings, had become the meaning of my life, an integral part of my personality, that I was striving to live and measure all things by it. Having no claims upon others, I bent the way the wind blew, rendering unto my environment that which was my environment's, and rendering unto myself that which I felt was mine. It was a dangerous way to live, far more dangerous than violating laws or ethical codes of conduct. But the danger was for me, and me alone. Had I not been conscious of what I was doing, I could have easily lost my way in the fog-bound regions of compelling fantasy. Even so, I floundered, staggered. But somehow, I always groped my way back to that path where I felt a tinge of warmth from an unseen light. Hungry for insight into my own life and the lives about me, knowing my fiercely indrawn nature, I sought to fulfill more than my share of all obligations and responsibilities, as though offering libations of forgiveness to my environment. Indeed, the more my emotions claimed my attention, the sharper, as though in ultimate self-defense, became my desire to measure accurately the reality of the objective world, so that I might more than meet its demands. At 20 years of age, the mold of my life was set, was hardening into a pattern that was neither good nor evil, neither right nor wrong.
This ends Disc 11.